And welcome back to Radio Primavera Sound. And it is an absolute pleasure to have with us Ian Wade, whose book, 1984, The Year Pop Went Queer, is released tomorrow. Ian, how are you doing?
Hello, Ben. I'm all right. Thank you. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. I'm very pleased that we've got you on at such a perfect time as well. I was thinking it was the end of the month, and that actually tomorrow, you know, it couldn't be better timed.
Oh yes, just before it all goes mad.
So I've been reading the book. I've been really enjoying it. I'm up to. I'm just about to start the chapter on the Pet Shop Boys. So I've read about a third of it, and it's really good, really enjoyable. Obvious question: why 1984?
I 1984 has long felt like a very much, well, it was the middle of the 80s, but also the end of a particular strand of the 80s, where it was like the end of the new pop before a more socially conscious rest of the 80s came along. Also, looking at the book as kind of bookended by Frankie Goes Hollywood, Relax, and Dead or Alive, You Spin Me Round, and all the events that sort of happen in the book, from Bronski Beat, Pet Shop Boys, High Energy, it all sort of, it's a gentle hovering of gay culture and pop music. And a lot of things like the rise of High Energy and like the rise of Pet Shop Boys and people like that kind of dictated what would happen for the rest of the decade. And also sort of dance culture, various club cultures was changed, you know. There's a lot going on, and also because politically there's various things, especially the rise of AIDS in the background as well, and also things like the miners' strike, where gay and lesbian voices, LGBTQ plus voices, were being heard primarily more for the first time in the wider landscape, and it all sort of all became one thing in that whole year, I feel.
Yeah, it's very interesting, the structure, because you take us through the year in political events as well. I mean, you talk about what's happening with the AIDS crisis, and I haven't got to the miners' strike yet, but as you say, it's coming. And every chapter sort of looks at a particular act, and it's really fantastic. I mean, you kick off with Frankie Goes to Hollywood. I was wondering if that was like the obvious first choice.
It was. It's chronologically, because Relax was, they had their Top of the Pops debut on January the 5th, 6th, and so it just seemed a good place to start. The fact that that record had been sort of knocking around for about 3 months outside the chart and finally broke through to the top 40, and it was that performance that, boom, kind of accelerated their career. And I thought that was just as good a place to start. It's sort of, I mean, it's quite interesting how a lot of the records, yes, it's 1984, but there's a lot of sort of a 1983-ness in there. But Relax, yeah, I couldn't really, it's kind of, Relax is kind of, couldn't not be mentioned in that, in the book. But yes, it had to kind of, Frankie, it could have been a love letter to Frankie, this entire book, to be honest, but I had to kind of hold back.
That's the next book.
Yeah, possibly. I don't know. I think I was kind of in danger at one point of thinking, oh, well, that actually the amount of words I've got for this original chapter has kind of dwarfed everything else. So kind of retreat back a bit.
Did you think of other years? Like, did you think, well, maybe it should be 1983, maybe it should be 1985? Or was it always like 1984 was the obvious year?
Well, what happened originally when I started the book, I wanted to celebrate sort of doing like the LGBT record collection to kind of coincide with Stonewall 50 years. And I sort of made a big list of all the years and who would be relevant for each sort of year, you know, there'd be Bowie, Suede, Katie Lang, all this sort of thing.
But you were saying like why it had to be 1984, and I think you were talking about the 50th anniversary of Stonewall and how you put together a big playlist.
Yeah, basically with I was making an idea of the LGBTQ plus, you know, one of those sort of not 1,000 records you should listen to before you die, but you know, the sort of catalogue. And that was my original idea of the book. And going through each year where I was feeling like, you know, Bowie, Suede, K.D. Lang, all these kind of allies and gay acts, 1984 kept growing and growing and growing, with, you know, obviously Frankie High Energy, and also the other big stars who were still around at that time. I say still around, I mean, Boy George was the biggest star in the country at the beginning of 1984. But there was also sort of a bit of a flavouring going on with, I don't know, it was quite interesting looking at the sort of magazines of the day, the pop magazines, smash hits and things like that, where they were bringing these subjects into kids' homes, not in a really dodgy way, but it was sort of quite a frank kind of, well, these acts, these are what they do. And there was still a kind of clash of, you still had some of your pop stars saying, oh, I haven't met the right girl yet, when they were asked, who's your girlfriend? But then with Frankie and Bronski coming along, they were just like, no, we're here, we're queer, sort of thing. And also the revolutionary thing about people like Bronski is they just look like everyday people. They just look like your next door neighbor. And I think that in itself was kind of the breakthrough, because there was still in the air a sort of very, I don't know, my generation, I'm 54, sorry, don't, you know, arrest me. My generation came through kind of things like the representation of people like Larry Grayson, John Inman, and it was all very camp, very, you know, mind your back. So it was all just really not particularly pleasant. So someone like Bronski Beat coming through was just unbelievable. And that in itself kind of just, I think, changed a lot of attitudes to people, you know, and also they're adjacent to kind of the Miners' Strike and various bits and pieces. And yeah, that was, I felt that was kind of the major breakthrough for 1984 to be the focus of the book.
You were 14, right, in 1984?
14, 15, yeah.
So I'm wondering, how did you see all this kind of music, the kind of music you're writing about now? Like, did you sort of understand what they were talking about? Did you?
No, it's interesting. I kind of, reflecting back to myself back then, it was sort of, I don't know, maybe without getting into too much detail, I think puberty came along and I was kind of beginning to question things, I suppose. I wasn't particularly that interested in kind of various bits and pieces. Frankie, I think I was just overwhelmed by, I'd seen the adverts, I'd seen sort of the photos of Holly and Paul in Rubber and various things like that. And I was just like, well, that's interesting. Do you know what I mean? You're not getting that with the Thompson twins. And that kind of intrigued me. And also the whole kind of cult-like thing around Sanctum Tum, I was kind of being seduced by the advertising and marketing of that. As for the actual kind of what people were singing about as such, it was beginning to creep in, I'd say. I think I was starting to kind of become a little bit more sensible. And yeah, at school I'd been a bit of an, not of an arsehole, but I sounded really irritating when I was going through my school reports at the beginning of this book. And I'm sure there are plenty of people saying, yes, you were really irritating, but I'm trying to put the bright side all that now.
Well, because that's the thing, like, particularly in the intro, you talk about yourself, and I think you give a very sort of personal side to the book. Was that your intention, to kind of put some of yourself in there as well?
I think so. Yeah, well, yes, it was. I mean, there's no thing to about it. I think the it kind of made me want to kind of like, well, this is why I'm writing it, and this is how I was feeling through all this. And I think, you know, it's 40 years now, and I know kind of lots of younger gay people who they didn't really have to go through perhaps the struggles, or they have a lot more lot easier. There's a lot more visibility, and in a way it's kind of, I felt like, you know, that whole year and that whole era was kind of being overlooked in some ways. I think when you have the sort of official narrative of kind of rock and pop history, there are certain things that kind of get, you know, bypassed. And it was just important to kind of think, well, actually, you know, when you're in the midst of it and when all this is happening, it is really important and does feel amazing. And that's what it kind of felt like. Excuse me.
I mean, I think I was saying before off camera that I was seven at the time, and I found it absolutely fascinating because I had no idea. Like, I remember the rumor was Relax had been banned because it was about sex, and that was, you know, that was all I knew. And like, I must have seen that video many times and just thought, ah, you know, they're at a club. I find it fascinating.
It is interesting. It's the thing with age as well. It's sort of when you realise, you look back on the Village People and like, oh, the biker has got like a red hanky and Holly's wearing a yellow hanky in the Top the Pops performance, and there's a song called Crisco Kisses. And you just think, oh, well, what I know now is like, good heavens, what they got away with, you know. But I mean, with the whole thing of Relax, I mean, that cover of the single, it's sort of interesting because what is going on there? And you know, there's part of you is like, is that sex? Do you know what I mean? That's not kind of interesting. But yeah, is that what goes on in those circles? And so, you know, it's kind of like, oh, well, maybe I should investigate. And so it's like you start going down these tunnels of kind of investigations. It's sort of quite a, yeah. So you're being told something is like rude and bad and sort of, you know, should be banned. And then your part of you is like, well, why? And so then that kind of piques your kind of interest in questioning. So,
see, I was trying to remember at this time. And okay, all right, Frankie Goes to Hollywood, the song was banned by Radio 1 or some Radio 1 DJs. But I don't remember, and maybe this is me misremembering, I don't remember there being, you know, a lot of people getting annoyed by Frankie Goes to Hollywood or Bronski Beat or something. I mean, it seemed to just like people just kind of accepted it.
Yeah, I think, you know, without wanting to kind of throw too much shade at Mike Reed, well, him banning it, he kind of positioned himself as the moral kind of guardian of that whole thing. You know, when you read about his radio show in the morning, he had kind of the most important kind of slot on radio in general. And so for him to kind of say, I'm not playing this and what have you, just seemed a little bit like, you know, well, hang on, it's still in the top five, it's still number one or whatever, you know, you know, you're kind of against the odds. And the fact that, you know, BBC Radio had played it several times, well, about sort of 70 or 80 times before, it just seemed a bit wrong that his kind of decision just to play it, not play it, kind of became this, not sort of not countrywide band, because a lot of independent stations were still playing it, but it just seemed unfair that Frankie couldn't celebrate their number one by being on Top of the Pops for those 5 weeks when it was number one. But because people were still buying it, people weren't buying it because it was rude or anything like that, people were buying it because it was ace.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, if when you look at kind of Frankie, kind of compare them to, say, the previous most shocking thing, like the Sex Pistols or whatever, Sex Pistols records didn't really hang around or anything. Whereas Relax, that had something more to it than just the kind of controversy. And I think the fact, you know, I talked to someone last night about the actual chart stats of Relax, where it was spent the entire year of 1984 in the top 40, going up and down and up to number two and all this sort of thing. You know, the shock and awe of controversy doesn't kind of sell records at that level. It's got to be a good song in the first place. And that's what I think, you know, most people liked about it. You know, the gay audience wouldn't have kind of kept that going like that at all.
Oh yeah, it was a massive record, sold millions, didn't it?
Oh, it's the biggest selling UK debut single. Which is incredible, even if you think of, like, you know, the people that have come since, like Spice Girls and all that sort of stuff, where you're told they're huge. But you know, I think the kind of the year Frankie had is kind of just overlooked in a way. It's sort of almost kind of so massive for a brand new band to have done what they did as well. That's why I kind of had to kind of begin with them, and it became a bit of a love letter.
Pete Perfidis, about the book, said it's it mentions a pop revolution hiding in plain sight. That seems like a good description. What do you think?
I think so, definitely. It's a lovely description indeed. It's also, I think, you know, when you think about some of the people I've written about in there who weren't necessarily out at the time, people like George Michael and, you know, Pet Shop Boys and things like that, you know, looking through the lens of hindsight and thinking, oh, you know, what they were saying, what they were singing. Because George actually came out to the rest of the band at the beginning of 1984. So, you know, my sort of writer's ability thinking, well, yeah, he's gay. He was gay. He was, you know, that was it. Whether he was out or whether he decided to park it for kind of the sake of career, that's fine. But he was a gay act. And between him and Frankie, they spent half the year at number one, you know, and that's, you know, George would go on in a few years later to kind of be more explicit about it. You know, Fast Love with the songs about kind of going outside, bumming and all this sort of stuff. It's, he has to kind of be in there. And, you know, I think, again, a lot of gay ideas were coming through. This is also kind of an era before sort of branding and kind of PR kind of took over as well, I think. So it's just that post-punk idea of kind of ideas and people just coming together and all that. And it didn't really matter whether your sexuality is. There's a lot of kind of times where you get a press release for something now and says, oh, queer artist, this, that, and the other. And you just think, whereas, you know, nobody really gave much of a, can't say shit.
you can.
Oh, okay.
We're in Spain, so it's like, you know.
Oh, okay. No one gave a shit back then.
So I actually want, because you're a DJ and a journalist. You DJ Ducky, which is one of the places which I've never been to, but I've heard is absolutely excellent. What do you make of the state of pop in 2024?
It's good. There's Rude Health. There's lots of individual people coming through. I think. There's very many characters. This is why I miss something like Smash Hits. When you've got people like Chapman Roan and Charlie XCX and various people like that, it's very visual. I really like a lot of sort of pop at the moment. I'm not so perhaps so wild about this sort of boohoo country kind of type tinge that's going through at the moment. No offense to any other fellow guests, but... yeah, you know, there's still a very sort of big generation of pop girls coming through at the moment, and it's a rap girl summer, as they say. I think it's great. I think it'd be nice if it sort of just broke through a little bit more. But I mean, it is, you know, it's we talked about, you know, Relax kind of being hanging around forever. You know, a lot of records now, due to kind of streaming and what have you, just hang around for just as long as they do now. But yes, I think pop is in rude health. I think it's just that there isn't really kind of the venues or avenues for people to kind of, you know, show that or share that. I think there was a bit of a danger of kind of Taylor Swift kind of hogging the bandwidth, which, you know, I can understand from SE, all this sort of stuff. But, you know, I'm sort of big Dua fan, all these sort of things. I think it's in... We do a wave of kind of boohoo troubadours and sobbing kind of blokes again, because it's been the ladies have kind of run things for a few years now. But it's a, yeah, oh, you know, pop music is important. It kind of also ebbs and flows. There's always something there.
What is Ducky like, by the way? As I said, I've never been, but I've had it thoroughly recommended.
Ducky is... all welcome. I mean, it started about 27 years ago. I've not been DJing there, but it's sort of a place where I think a lot. It was put together to be sort of a gay space. Back in the 90s in London, gay clubbing was either trade, where, you know, you spent all your week down the gym just so you could kind of just get your tops off and listen to Anonymous Hard House, or it was kind of cabaret-led, kind of quite cheesy, very predictable, oh, he's outrageous. Whereas Ducky, the playlist was Anything Goes. You know, you could go in there and sort of you'd be sort of listening to Boys Town Gang, and then it's the Stranglers, and then, you know, and I think Ducky's place in London nightlife history is assured, because it's just the fact that it just treated gay people like, well, you know, you all like these records. It's you don't, you're not going to just necessarily have to listen to kind of the Pet Shop Boys and Divine. You know, we're all kind of got record collections. But also, it's been such a brilliant space in the last sort of, so however many years, 27 years, to be sort of for people to go to, and also just to meet and mix with other people, because again, gay clubbing was very kind of ghettoized with kind of certain type of look or a certain type of person, what have you. But it's such a fantastic space. But yes, you have to come down. Yeah, it's all as welcome. You know, it's just, it's not sort of, oh, it's just a big old knees up, really.
Well, I remember a few years ago you did a party at Sitges, just down the road from here, and I didn't go, but there we go.
Oh, well, I wasn't there. Yeah. I think there's this kind of working men's club kind of vibe there with Ducky, where it's sort of like, it kind of entertains, I don't know. There's all sorts of things that kind of come into their culture, but it's kind of that working men's club kind of here are the turns and all this sort of stuff vibe. But also, it's just a really good space to kind of just lose your shit to. I think the key tunes like Dancing on My Own by Robin and Left to My Own Devices and stuff like that, you know, you put those on if anything's flagging. If you're kind of experimental, kind of like, oh, I don't think this Stereolab track is working, and you just like, bang, there's Robin, deal with it, you know. So, but yeah, it's just an amazing, amazing club, and a long may it continue.
Back to the book, you've been on tour, right? How's it been?
I've only done a couple of dates so far. I did one in my hometown, which was my first sort of thing, and which was really lovely. I was kind of just nervy all day, but that was lovely. And again, not only was it kind of supporting Darlane Books in Ipswich, which is the only independent bookshop, it also was suddenly I was surrounded by people I hadn't seen since, you know, 1984 in some way. There's kind of people I went to school with, which is absolutely mad, because, you know, you go to school and you leave school and then you kind of get into another group of mates, and so kind of all these kind of people from all walks of my life were there, and it was just so lovely. But yeah, I'm looking forward to doing more events, sort of being asked the biscuit tin questions, all this sort of stuff. It's really fun. And I like the fact that lots of people are kind of identifying different chapters. I've had kind of, oh, I like the high energy chapter, the Sylvester chapter made me cry. Well, I didn't know that about this. And that's been fantastic. That's kind of all that I could ask for, really.
You mentioned the biscuit tin questions because you used to work for Smash Hits, didn't you?
Yeah, I mean, it was only sort of like for about sort of 6-7 months over a couple of years. But yeah, it's sort of not the vintage period. I'm not dissing Smash Hits vintage period at all. But it was kind of one of those, would you like to come in and work for Smash Hits? When I had the phone call, and I was just like, would I? Do you know what I mean? It's like a magazine that's kind of been, you know, my lifeblood for all those teenage years. And then for them to ask me to kind of go in and, you know, it was just sort of cover for mainly, but you know, with that, you were writing bits for news, song words, and doing kind of bits and pieces of interviews. And I mean, I never felt happier in a job. And there was kind of the HMV being around the corner for lunchtimes as well. It just felt like you were in the center of a mecca of pop music, and it's fantastic. Because I got the call when I was working at sort of Melody Maker, kind of on the doing PA cover. And I mean, I loved Melody Maker and I love all the people there, but Smash Hits was just like, oh my God, you know, this is my time. I just, you know, sort of just, I think that era, 98-99, so we're sort of talking sort of Steps, Solo Jerry, but then I was kind of going in sort of like still a big Blur fan with 13 and all that sort of stuff. I managed to kind of review the singles as well, which is sort of like a light goal achieved, you know, like when I'm on my deathbed, I thought, well, I reviewed the singles and smash hits. That's kind of like achievements.
And also kind of, I feel Smash Hits as plays a role in the book as well. I mean, you know, there's a few quotes from Smash Hits, but it's also, I think maybe it shows like how important Smash Hits was to kind of the pop scene at the time.
Yeah, I mean, Smash Hits was the biggest influence on my sort of style of writing. And just that sort of irreverence where, you know, it sort of dings and yaru and yikes and all this sort of stuff. Again, there's people like Paul, like Tom Hibbert and Sylvia Patterson, you know, Neil Tennant and various people like that who are like my biggest heroes as a writer. But I think Smash Hits, you know, back in the days when I, you know, 1984, they never treated you or patronized you in any way. It was sort of, you were on the adventure, you know, as well. And I think a few pop magazines that tried to be Smash Hits failed to kind of get that. I think with Smash Hits, it's sort of the writer themselves were as excited, but they're not like going, oh, you know, oh, you kids, all this sort of stuff. And also, you know, you read some of the sort of early Smash Hits. I mean, the Light Pump Never Happened has got all the scans of all the Smash Hits up until 1990. And you just read the kind of quality of the writing and everything. Just think, some of the ideas that they were kind of getting through, you know, and I was like, well, I read that when I was 12, bloody hell. You know, it's like, you know, especially in the 1984 thing, there's a kind of a section called May the Best... Best Man Win, which is Boy George, Marilyn, Pete Burns, Tasty Tim, all kind of talking about, you know, being gender benders and like, you know, and you just think, well, that's not, you wouldn't get that in a kind of teen mag now. And there was a Smash Hits kind of introduced, I think just after Malcolm McLaren with Buffalo Girls, there was kind of like a history of hip hop and break dancing. You know, I think a lot of people, I get very, very, very angry when people say, oh, Smash Hits was just for little girls, because it's like, absolutely not. You know, you do, if it was for little girls, you wouldn't have Bauhaus on the cover. Do you know what I mean? So, yes, it's a very, very important magazine.
I seem to remember them having Jesus and Mary Chain on the cover as well, which, or maybe not the cover, but certainly they were in there.
Yeah, I don't know. If somebody posted like, oh, 37 years to go today or something, and it's an amazing cover. It's like the sort of artwork and everything. Jesus, Mary Jane, loud, spotty and weird. And it's like, well, again, what's the angle there? It's like, well, we're kind of excited about this band enough to kind of put them on the cover, but they're loud, spotty and weird. You know, it's just that sort of, I think around the same time there was Paul Robert Smith in a fish tank and all this sort of stuff. And, you know, especially they weren't puncturing the sort of alternative kind of po-faced sort of indie stars. It was kind of, it's just seemed like to, I don't know, I just don't, it's just, it was just fun. And I think it's, I think a lot of these people who are with too sort of cool for school actually secretly loved being interviewed by Smash Hits, because, you know, they weren't going to be asked the sort of worthy questions that perhaps Enemy and Melody Maker were going to ask. It was actually going to be like a bit of fun.
Ian, thank you so much for taking the time. The book 1984, The Year Pop Went Queer, is out tomorrow.
Yay!
I thoroughly, thoroughly recommend it. It's an excellent read. As I said, I'm about a third of the way through, but that's in like literally a day. It's very unput downable. no, really, really great, really interesting. Going through some acts I love, some acts I didn't know much about, you know, some acts I know really well, putting them all together in context. And it's great. I'm really looking forward to reading the rest of it. Thank you so much for coming on. And yeah, sorry about the technical difficulties, but what would Interview be without technical difficulties? I should ask, any plans for a sort of Spanish edition?
Let's see how it goes, I guess. I think when I sort of narcissistically put my name into a search engine and saw that it's being sold like various countries, if Spain wants it and somebody can translate it, let's go for it. Yeah,
they should do it. Definitely.
Yeah.
All right, we'll have a very good release day. Go and, I don't know, celebrate in whichever way you feel is appropriate.
Yeah, probably just a really nice breakfast, and I might treat myself to a drink later on, but yeah.
Perfect. All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Cheers, Ben. Take care. Bye. Bye.